Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So I'm going to talk about sustainability. So, and we're going to talk about the definitional challenges with that. But kind of to set the stage, what I like to do is show this graph here, right? So we hear a lot about world population. World population is growing. I think it's really instructive to actually graph it out and see what's happening, okay? So on this graph here, I have from 10,000 BC, okay? So that date is significant because that is when agriculture began, right? It's essentially the start of human civilization, projected out to 2050, okay? So when we look at what happens with our human population over that time period, right? I like to say we kind of look like an out-of-control bacteria growth, right, on planet Earth. It's definitely exponential. So it took us till 1804 to hit a billion people, and essentially took us 12 years to gain the last billion on planet Earth, right? So that's a tremendous growth rate. So that sets up a challenge of we have increasing growth of human population, we have increasing demand for food, and as the last speaker just set out, we have increasing incomes as well. So increasing incomes, increasing population translates into this, that we have a projection of about a 70% increase in demand for meat, for animal protein in the world by 2050. Okay? So how do we meet that increased demand with one planet Earth sustainably? Right? We don't have multiple Earths to use resources from. It's a good question, but of course, what is sustainability? Right? And that's usually the biggest challenge, is trying to define what is sustainability. What does it mean? So a lot of this discussion has started with environmental impact. So does sustainability mean environmental impact? Is that what it's all about? And I would say no, right? We have to consider the economics. We have to consider social issues, right? If you're not in business, if you can't make green, you're not going to be green in terms of being sustainable, right? So those different factors are all important in sustainability. We're talking about economics, social issues, and environmental issues. So the other challenge with sustainability, and this is something I like to put up in terms of a concept and a frame of reference of why this is so difficult, is sustainability is what we would call a wicked problem, okay? Believe it or not, wicked problems, they actually have a definition, okay? The definition is that it's such a problem that it doesn't have one solution, okay? It can't really be solved, it can only be managed, right? There's no single point that we're going to reach and say, we're done, we're sustainable. So why is that? One, there's no clear definition of the problem with sustainability. There's no right or wrong answer. It's not a black or white issue. We can get better, we can get worse. It's not a continuum, but there's no right or wrong answer when we're thinking about this. And then this is a big one. Stakeholders have very different ways of looking at the problem, right? If we ask an environmental NGO, what does beef sustainability mean to you? The answer is going to be probably way different than if we poll this room. Right? So, but all those people are stakeholders within the beef value chain. And so that's why this is such a challenge. People come at this from a definitionally different angles. And then the last part that makes this wicked is that the causes and effects, all the things that interact in the beef system and all these things that fall under this large umbrella of sustainability are complicated. They're complex, they're interrelated. We can model some of them, but we can't understand all of them. Some of these things are essentially unknowable. So this is what makes sustainability such a challenge. It's a wicked problem. So after I said there's no definition for sustainability, I like to offer my definition for sustainability. So if we're going to think about producing safe, nutritious beef, what would make that sustainable? I would say long-term business viability, stewardship of natural resources, and responsibility to community, family, and animals. Okay, so within that definition are those three components: economics, the environment, and our social issues, right? So really what it's about is a balance of those three. It's at the nexus of those three. And of course, the challenge is that's going to be different for every single operation, depending on the resources that you have, depending on where you're at. I always like to say in Oklahoma, I mean, we have a precipitation gradient of 65 inches to about 15 inches out in the panhandle. So what is going to work in one area is not going to be the same everywhere, right? So it's about not one-size-fits-all solutions, but about balancing those things within an operation. So with that all said, again, kind of give a little history, a little context of where this issue is coming from. A lot of it has been derived from environmental pressures, right? So just some Some examples here. This was a report that came out that said that 51% of greenhouse gas emissions come from animal agriculture in the world. Okay? They counted all of respiration of animals, so that was a little flawed methodology on their part. We have a PETA person here dressed as a chicken, and then we have this political cartoon that says, "Have some more beans, Bessie, global warming acid axis of evil." Okay? So what is this, all this getting at? It's getting at climate change, right? It's getting at greenhouse gas emissions, greenhouse effect. So just a little refresher on what the greenhouse effect is. We, of course, have the sun that hits planet Earth. Sunlight travels 93 million miles away. Some of it gets reflected back out into space. Some of it gets trapped in the atmosphere by these greenhouse gases, okay? That's important. If we didn't have the greenhouse effect, it would be a lot colder on Earth than it is right now, right? So with the greenhouse effect, the global average temperature is about 57 degrees Fahrenheit. Without it, it'd be below the freezing point of water. So the greenhouse effect is a good thing that we have that to trap heat in the Earth's atmosphere. Okay. And the Earth's climate has not been static. It's changed over time. Okay, so this is what, to some evidence of that, this is looking at changes in temperature. So that blue squiggly line here is essentially changes in temperature over 450,000 years. So this is the time scale that we're looking at here. This is data that came from an ice core in Antarctica. Okay, so these changes show us essentially interglacial periods and ice ages is what's going on here. From that same ice core, we can look at concentrations of carbon dioxide. Okay, so that's one of those greenhouse gases you hear a lot about in the media, right? CO2, carbon dioxide. So that's what this green line is showing here. And as you can see, there's a strong correlation between temperature change and CO2 concentrations. And there's no controversy that CO2 is a greenhouse gas or that other gases have this effect, right? We know that. We've known that for over 100 years. The challenge is that just like with our population graph, we've had an increase in recent times. Okay, so this is looking at CO2 concentrations. This is that same graph of the past 450,000 years. And then once we hit the last 100 years, we've spiked right up in our CO2 concentrations. Okay, 350 was kind of or 300 parts per million was our ceiling. And now we're over 400 parts per million in the atmosphere. It's a very trace amount, small amount, but it makes a big effect in terms of our climate. Okay, and so most of that, of course, is coming from the burning of fossil fuels, right? Which, of course, what does that have to do with cattle production, right? There are other gases that do this in terms of trapping heat in the Earth's atmosphere, and this is why there has been so much attention drawn to animal agriculture in particular, okay? So these different gases have different global warming potentials or abilities to trap heat in the Earth's atmosphere. So we have a scale to compare all these gases back to carbon dioxide. And on this scale, we give carbon dioxide a global warming potential of 1. Methane gas, okay, so this is a gas that's produced in the rumen of ruminants, right, like cattle, has a global warming potential of 28. So that means that one molecule of methane equals 28 molecules of CO2, okay, 28 times more potent at trapping heat. Nitrous oxide has a global warming potential of 265. Nitrous oxide is a gas that comes from microbial processes, usually from soil, okay, from wet soils. So these gases come from agriculturally related activities, and this is a big reason why there's been so much attention drawn to carbon footprints of agricultural products, okay? For example, this is an ad that was run in a lot of different publications. So if you can't read it, it says, which one of these contributes more to global warming? Okay, so it's got a picture of a fork and car keys. And then it says, it's not the one that starts the car. And then in the fine print, it says, according to the UNFAO, 18% of greenhouse gas emissions come from animal agriculture. Now, this ad that was run was paid for by the Humane Society of the United States. Right? So this is a welfare organization, but they're making an environmental argument against eating meat products, okay? Or this movie poster, right? There's a documentary called Cowspiracy, and that's actually not a joke. That's a real movie that's out there if you haven't heard of it. It has about 59,000 likes on Facebook, right? So there's more people that like that than like E-Extension on Facebook, which is unfortunate, right? So these intrepid filmmakers here, they describe themselves as such, are talking about the environmental impact of cattle production in this documentary, okay, and saying that this is something that's been swept under the rug, despite the fact that, as we'll talk about, this stuff has been public knowledge for quite a while. But this is the type of thing that the public is seeing all the while, and it comes back and back and back again to greenhouse gas emissions from animal agriculture, okay, as a starting point. So where do all these numbers come from? They come from this report that came out in 2006, okay, by the UN, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. So some of you may have heard of this before. It's called Livestock's Long Shadow. Okay, so it was really kind of the starting point in recent years to draw all this attention to this issue. Okay, so this was a 400-plus page report. There was some good information in there, for sure, but there were two sentences that were pulled out of the executive summary that got all the media attention that are used by Humane Society, etc., in these ads. So those two sentences were, the livestock sector is a major player responsible for 18% of GHG, that's greenhouse gas emissions, measured in CO2e. Those are those CO2 equivalents we just talked about, the global warming potential issue. Okay, this is a higher share than transport. Okay, so they're implying there that animal agriculture produces more than all global transportation, and that's where the Humane Society got their ad from, okay, from this sentence. So how did they come up with this? They used the life cycle assessment in Livestock's Long Shadow. So what is a life cycle assessment? You're going to get a lot better detail from somebody that's an expert later, right after me. But just to give you kind of an overview of what this looked like for Livestock's Long Shadow, essentially a life cycle assessment is an accounting system where you're adding, you're summing all the greenhouse gas emissions that occur along the entire production chain. Okay, so that's what this graph, this chart here is showing of what they did in Livestock's Long Shadow. So they took into account things related to feed production, land use change, we'll talk about this a little bit more, on-farm, so enteric fermentation. This is the methane that the animals produce in their rumen. Okay, that was one of the biggest chunks of the carbon footprint that they calculated. Processing and transportation didn't really show up too much in this life cycle assessment, but I want to focus in on what essentially was over a third of their 18%, which was land use change, okay? So land use change, well, first we'll talk about enteric fermentation. Again, this is something that the media often gets wrong. You'll hear about, of course, cow farts. It comes out the front end of the animal, right? So it's not, that's one of those simple things that often gets misconstrued in the media, okay? So enteric methane is a natural part of the animal's process and digesting all that fibrous material. So land use change included in this report both desertification, which is taking grassland and degrading it to the point where it turns into a desert, okay, so as this picture shows here. And the big one was deforestation, okay? So with this report, essentially in both of those scenarios, the lost ability of that plant matter to take up CO2, because as we know, plants like CO2, right? They use that for producing all the matter that we use, all that biomass. So all the lost CO2 potential of this forest and the methane emissions that these cattle are belching out, that would all be counted as an emission towards animal agriculture in this assessment, okay? So the challenge with that is that this process of land use change, of course, is not happening in the same way everywhere in the world. Okay, so this is actually a map from Livestock's Long Shadow. And the main thing to take away from this is the red areas, this is where we actually have these processes taking place. Okay, this is where we have a net loss of forest. So where is that occurring? Occurring in the Amazon, Southeast Asia, right? Those type places in the world, developing nations, where people are trying to expand and they're taking over land that has been previously undeveloped. That's where that land use change is taking place. In the dark green, which is pretty much where all the United States is, that is where we actually have a net gain of forest land in the United States, right? So rather than having this process take place in countries that are developed like the United States, the opposite has been true, okay? So that over a third of a chunk in that report does not really apply to the United States at all. The other thing, of course, is that livestock are not equally distributed around the world, just like people aren't. So this is just looking at all the aggregate distribution of all livestock and poultry around the world. The red refers to darker. The darker red is where we have more animals per square kilometer. Okay. So the middle part of the country, parts of, again, South America, India, and China, there's a lot of people in those countries. There's a lot of livestock in those countries as well. So why is this important? Because when we look at the relative size of the economy of these nations relative to animal agriculture, that's going to shift what percentage animal agriculture contributes to the carbon footprint of the country. Right? If we're here in the United States and we have a lot of transportation, a lot of electricity generation, that's going to dwarf our country's carbon footprint for beef, etc. Okay. So to that point, a publication came out a few years later, and then one of the co-authors is going to speak next from this, okay, that was called Clearing the Air. And essentially what this publication showed is that livestock, or concluded, livestock's long shadow is a global assessment. We should not have these issues of taking global numbers and applying them regionally, okay? So for example, in the United States, about 3.6% of greenhouse gas emissions come from all of animal agriculture, okay? Not just the beef industry, but that's all of animal agriculture, okay? So it's not 18%. It's far lower here in the United States. Again, because that's that issue of we have so much else contributing to greenhouse gas emissions in this country that animal agriculture is dwarfed, okay? If we were in a developing country like Paraguay or Ethiopia, that percentage is going to be far higher. Okay. Again, because of the relative size of the rest of their economy related to animal agriculture. So that makes sense. Mainly, it's kind of nonsensical to take these percentages and apply them to different places when they don't really apply to those areas, right? That's kind of an inappropriate comparison. The last thing, and this is very important, is that transportation was not analyzed with a life cycle assessment. Okay, so we'd use this complicated methodology to sum everything in the value chain for animal agriculture, but not for transportation. That was not done, right? They just looked at how much fossil fuel is burned in these vehicles, not all that goes into making those vehicles, refining the oil, etc., right? If we did that, it would be far higher, okay? So it was an inappropriate comparison to begin with, and, of course, it doesn't really apply to everywhere. So as a follow-up, the UN has updated their methodology, right? They've done another life cycle assessment. They've lowered what their estimate was for what these greenhouse gas emissions was. Anthropogenic means human caused. So they've lowered by about 4% their estimate. And the other thing they did was they looked at emissions per region instead of just looking at the world total, and that's it. Right? So they disaggregated it by region. And what they found is that regions that have more modern intensive production systems, like the United States, have much lower greenhouse gas emissions per unit of meat, per unit of beef. Okay, so with that technology, with that efficiency that we have here in this country, all those gains that we've made, we have lower, much lower carbon footprints, much lower environmental impacts per unit of beef. So that's a little bit of a background of why there's so much attention drawn to this issue, right? Drawn to sustainability. It comes from this environmental angle to start with, okay? So what is missing from this debate? A lot of context, I would argue. One, what does a percentage, a snapshot in time, really mean? Are we getting better? Are we getting worse? Do we even know? Can we measure it? Another thing that's important to realize is all this attention that's drawn to enteric methane and how bad ruminants are, and particularly cattle, because they produce all this methane. We have to put that in context of what those cattle are actually doing, right? So I think this is important, is that less than 1% of that solar energy that hits planet Earth is actually captured by plants, captured by photosynthesis, okay? That's important because that low efficiency drives all life on Earth, right? All of us depend on that efficiency of solar energy captured by those plants. However, almost all of that energy is trapped up in this compound cellulose, okay? And we cannot break that compound down at all in our digestive tracts, right? The only thing that can break these bonds between all these glucose units here is bacteria. And those bacteria live within the rumen of cattle, right? So essentially what cattle are bioreactors, right? They're solar energy converters. That's what they're doing. They're taking this tremendous amount of solar energy that is trapped up in fibrous material, and they're converting it into human usable products. They're allowing the rest of the food chain to capture this energy. That's what ruminants are doing. So they produce a little methane as well, but that's got to be weighed against the service that they're doing, right? And that's usually lost in all of these debates. But we're not talking about cattle in that way. So the other thing, are we getting better or are we getting worse? This is a little outdated. We just looked at some of the newer charts in terms of where cow numbers are in the United States. So if we were going to add on the last couple of years, we'd have a little blip going up. But the overall trend is there, right? We peaked in the early 1970s in terms of cow numbers in the United States. However, when we look at beef production, we have the same peak, right, in the 70s. However, if we overlay those two graphs, we essentially produce the same amount of beef today with 30% fewer animals. Now, that's a tremendous change in efficiency if we're thinking about using our resources more wisely if we have a growing population. So a little bit of context with this. This is a study that came out in Journal of Animal Science by Jude Capper, and this is looking at comparing that historical data of 1977 to 2007. Okay, so these black bars are 100% of what we were using in 1977, and these orange bars are what the industry was doing in 2007. Okay, so when we look across all these different categories of resource use and environmental impact, we've had declines in all those categories. Okay, so what is happening here? Production efficiency. We're doing more with less. If we have a growing world population, we have one planet Earth, we're going to need to do a lot more of this, right? Doing more with less. That's really key, and the industry's been doing that. So what is going to affect production efficiency? All those things that you're going to talk about here at this meeting, right? Genetics, reproductive efficiency, etc. All those things that you're going to try to do to be a better producer, to help your bottom line, those are the type of things that can help lower environmental impacts, right? Those are the things that you do that you don't maybe think about from that perspective, but they do have an impact on it. So pulling out a little bit, there are, of course, a lot of other issues that are important to sustainability. And one of those is food insecurity. And this is something that, again, needs to be balanced when we're talking about all these different issues, and hopefully becomes a bigger part of the discussion. So this is looking at it from a global perspective. These numbers were just updated, and I think we're below 800 million, but we're still pretty close to 800 million, or 1 in 9 people in the world are malnourished, okay? That's a tremendous number of people. That's over twice the U.S. population that are malnourished in the world, okay? We've made a lot of declines. That's what that's showing in terms of reducing the number of malnourished people, but we still have a tremendous number of people that do not get enough to eat in the world. So why is that important? It's important from a humanitarian perspective, from a moral perspective. But I think this is interesting as well in terms of what the effects are on the stability of countries and national security, right? So this is a headline from December 19th, 2010. Witnesses report rioting in Tunisian town. Any idea what this is? Any guesses? What was happening in Tunisia in late 2010? This is the start of the Arab Spring, okay? So the start of the Arab Spring was a street vendor that could not afford to buy the vegetables to sell on the street. So he ended up actually lighting himself on fire, and that was the spark that lit the Arab Spring that obviously we're still dealing with all the repercussions today, okay? So food security is not just a humanitarian issue. It's an issue that has geopolitical implications in terms of the stability of countries, okay? And it's not something that's just global, but it has implications here in the United States. We're about 20% of U.S. households that have children have food security issues. In the United States, it's defined more as you don't know where your next meal is going to come from. In Oklahoma, the numbers are usually, what we hear is 1 in 4 Oklahoma children don't know where their next meal is going to come from. So that's a big deal, right, in terms of an issue. So do we not have enough food in the world? Not really. That's not really what causes food insecurity. It's usually issues with income inequality and distribution, etc. Because you could argue we have enough food in the world, right? We waste a tremendous amount of food. And if we're going to talk about sustainability of food systems, then we need to really probably focus in on this issue, number one. Okay? So according to the UNFAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, we waste about 1.3 billion tons of edible food every year, right? So we could probably feed those 800 million people if we could get that food to them. When we look at meat, about 20% of edible meat globally is lost. And that's actually the lowest, one of the lowest categories of loss, right? Because meat is a high-value product, as we just heard. People get more money in their pocket. They want to buy meat to improve their diet. So they're less likely to waste it. However, we still waste about 20%. In the United States, we waste about 66.5 million tons of edible food every single year, right? So then what do we do with that food? We usually throw it in a landfill and it produces methane gas. So what does that do to our carbon footprint of our food system, and how are we accounting for that? So what are some of the challenges for beef sustainability going forward? This is a slide that I've showed the last few years, and we're talking about Oklahoma and we're in drought. It's obviously a major challenge. We just heard about that. Now we have too much water in Oklahoma in the last few weeks. So we've kind of gone from one extreme to the other. But climate variability and those challenges that we always deal with in agriculture obviously always present a challenge for this idea of continuously improving our sustainability. The other major challenge that was alluded to earlier is the average age of a producer in the United States. Okay? So this is looking at not just beef, but all farm operators from the last ag census in 2012. So these counties that are outlined in these darker colors are where 40 or 45% or more of the operators, the farm operators in those counties, are over the age of 65, right? So where are the young people that are going to take over the farms, and can they actually get into the business? Are the barriers to entry too high that they're not going to be able to help the industry expand, right? We really have to think about this issue if we're going to talk about sustainability, not just carbon footprints, right? This is probably even more important. Another major challenge is animal welfare, right, and the perception of intensive systems. So we just talked about intensive systems probably lower our environmental impact. However, how do consumers view those systems? Not very positively, right? Whether we're thinking about feedlots, confinement dairies, battery cages, gestation stalls, etc., all those things have been in the news in terms of how people perceive those issues, right? And in the United States, 100% of us are eaters, but only about 2% of us actually are involved in the production of that food, right? So we can't ignore what 98% of people are thinking, right? That would be convenient, but that's not going to help us out in terms of how we deal with these issues. So what's not on that image? Cow-calf operations, right? So the beef industry probably has an advantage there in terms of that pastoral image being something that a lot of people liked to see, right? So what are the other major challenges? This is a review article that came out a few years ago, and they kind of outlined what the major challenges are. CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, as we just alluded to, intensive systems, animal welfare, food safety. All those things that have been issues are probably going to continue to be issues in terms of driving conversation about what consumers are concerned about. However, we have kind of two issues here. We have misinformation. Again, that was alluded to earlier. People don't really know. They're not really scientifically literate on a lot of issues. However, we also have differences in values, interests, and we have lack of trust. So it's really much more complicated than an educate the public issue. Okay, it has to be two-way communication. That means listening on both sides, which is challenging, and respectful dialogue. And that's going to be something that I don't have an answer for, but that's something that we really need to pay attention to and think about. It's not just educate the public, but it's rather a communication issue with sustainability. So there was a report that just came out by the National Research Council, and essentially it said that talking about where animal science research is going to contribute to sustainable food production over the next 40 years. And this was one of their major conclusions, that sustainable intensification and research to advance that, the major challenge, or one of the major challenges, is going to be closing this extensive and existing broad communication gap that exists between public, animal science researchers, everyone that's involved in the allied industries, and the general public, okay, the food industries. So there is a need to actually revitalize research infrastructure, extension infrastructure, to actually allow this to happen. Whether that does or not, we'll see, but that is one of those major challenges that are out there related to sustainability of beef production and all of animal agriculture. So with that, I'll leave you with, again, my definition: long-term business viability, stewardship of natural resources, responsibility to community, family, animals, producing safe, nutritious beef when doing that, That would be what sustainable beef production is. And it's about continuous improvement. All systems can be sustainable. It's just about getting better in all those different areas, whatever fits your operation. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions or pass it on to the next speaker. But thank you very much for your attention.